So you allow this. So was it a gift?
Open.
Thank you. Mr. Fix.
Sorry to bring my thoughts. It seems to be a long morning already for you. Some points I just wanted to clarify that have arisen from some of the earlier questions from other council, but I'm conscious of trying to steer carefully away from maps of plan and trying to as best I can within your wheelhouse, as it were, but you know that time as well. If I'm straying inappropriately. I think in answer to some questions from my friend Ms. Olman, you were talking about the issue of when fencing setbacks might not be practicable. And you talked about the importance of being able to assess the risks on the property and address those. In that regard, I presume you mean that in the event that you've got an issue as to practicability, you then look at measures that might mitigate those risks. Is that what you're saying there? As opposed to the issue of practicability reflecting risk, if you know what I mean? Sorry, I was probably a little confused. You're not... Are you taking into account the risk when you're making a judgment as to practicability, or are you taking into account whether it can or can't be done at a particular setback requirement?
So I guess you're taking into account the risk in its entirety from the physical characteristics of the land and the management practices. The practicability comes into, okay, we want to fence this, can we actually put the fence where we need to, and can we afford to do it? And it may be that you can't put a fence at all, or you can't put it where you need to, or you can't put it in the interim. The focus should then be on what can we do in the interim to minimise that risk. Even if you have identified that you're going to do your areas to fence, that doesn't mean, okay, we're fencing in 3 years' time, therefore we're still not going to take other measures that we can do now to minimise the risk. You would still be mindful of how you're raising that today.
Right, yeah. So, and that's where you talk about some of those kind of interim measures, location of troughs and pressure shade trees and those other types of things.
Yes, stop time.
So it seems to me that there are kind of perhaps two aspects to that issue of practicality, and I think possibly they're different. One, you talked about whether physically or geographically, I'm not sure that's the right term, but geographically you can put a fence in there, and then there are issues of practicality about potentially that might be about where your existing fences lines might be and joining those up in a sensible way without. Which is potentially an issue of practicability, not necessarily a cost issue. But then you've got issues such of cost, which go to more to the timing of when you can optimally fence rather than whether you physically can or can't. I think that's a slightly different aspect. Now, in terms of making those judgments about the risks of the property, when you're we were dealing with that. This is, and you talked about the importance of farm plans, and obviously there's farm plan specialists that are on property doing those assessments. Will they have the full skill set, in your view, to be able to make those risk assessments when we're talking, you know, in terms of the different variables that are at play in terms of mitigating the adverse effects on water quality?
So, I guess like the current training for certified farm management advisors for the freshwater farm plan is just beginning. I haven't undertaken that training, I have seen some of the modules. However, I am a certified nutrient management advisor and I am on the part of the standards group that looks to see whether somebody that isn't doing regular farm management plans or overseeing nutrient budgets has done enough to continue their certification. So from that process, that requires ongoing annual certification, a certain number of professional development hours and a certain number of modules that the person has to complete every year, plus providing evidence of their continued knowledge and continued work in the area. I would expect that the certification process would be similar to that process that I'm familiar with.
Thank you. So that issue of certification for that reason and the training that sits in behind it will be quite critical moving forward.
Absolutely.
And in that regard, do you think, obviously we've got vast differences in landscapes and the various variables that go into these equations around the country. So do you think some specific knowledge about some of those regional variances is an important aspect, or not, I'm not saying it's an essential one, but an important aspect of
it. It is an important aspect, and part of the training actually incorporates that. So there is a national module, so you know, the basics and the fundamentals of, and then there are regional specific trainings that my understanding are more in depth, and that takes into account the different characteristics, the different risks, I guess, or vulnerabilities of the protected bodies within a region in different catchments, those sorts of things. So each person, you can actually, you become certified for a particular region because of that.
Right, yes. And that would be quite important in the work of given those differences. So you'd be a certified farm plan for the purpose of certifying farms within the Waikato region, for example. I just want to clarify that because it's certainly something that's played on my mind about that regional specificity and uniqueness, and obviously it's a range of unique contexts that we're dealing with here, not least of all the PC1's going to give a rise to above and beyond whatever the national regulations are. So that's my point. I just have a query, and again, it may have been just, I may have misheard you, but when you were talking, I think, I've been asked some questions from the super this morning, but regarding Schedule C, and I thought I'd heard you say that, well, Schedule C really is applying to sort of low intensity farms. Of course, we've got Schedules D1 and D2 that are in the importance of farm plans with additional obligations that are applying elsewhere. Was that what you were saying? I was a little bit confused. It's the differentiation you were making.
Sorry.
Oh, good. That wasn't just me.
So, so 190. So this is the minimum standards. In my understanding, is that these must be met, and then if you can't meet them, you go through increasingly more pathways and.
Right, yes. Because my reading of it and understanding it, these Schedule C are the minimum farming standards that apply across the board in terms of stock exclusion. And then when we go to Schedule D1 and D2, any extra on, because D1 and D2 also require you to meet Schedule C as well.
Yes.
You, that's right.
Yes.
Excellent. No, that's useful. Now, I just wanted to just touch on the joyous topic of overseer, which you also touched carefully on. You're not an expert in overseer. It's not where of expertise as such. In terms of
so I've been a user of overseer for 17 years. Yeah. I, at Ed Research, was involved in testing of new models of overseer. I'm not a model developer.
Yes.
My expertise lies in using overseer, but I do have considerable experience using it and testing that model and testing new versions before releasing it.
Right. No, thank you for that clarification. I just wanted to check the scope which you were engaging with it. Now, obviously, here we're talking about overseer, and we've also talked about the non-humorous scorecard. Now, we're looking at that as, for the purposes of PC1, as a gateway tool. That's correct, isn't it? So that's how you get into the rules, essentially, as to where you fit. And so we're not focused here about the use of overseer in terms of, you know, mitigation analysis downstream. You've acknowledged that there is some potential with some risks in that regard, or some weaknesses. That would be fair.
Careful use.
Careful use. Right, yeah. And we're certainly not grappling with it in the context of an allocation methodology. So we need to be careful about where we're drawing these lines. You'd accept that?
Yes.
Yeah. And that careful use you've talked about in terms of using overseer for effective mitigation, again, it's a tool, isn't it? Or it's a model that's based on averaging, isn't it?
Yes, so it assumes it uses average climate data, so it's not looking at the climate data that year, and it assumes that the farm is in a steady state, so that you're not mid-conversion from one land use to another.
Yeah. And I think you've talked about, I think generally in your evidence, about some of the things that impact, for example, sedimentation is one example. The various factors there on the farms include not simply the activities you're carrying out, but matters of slope, soil moisture level, rainfall, etc. Those are all variables within on a farm by farm basis and on a region by region basis. And so, obviously, it's kind of doing averages of climatic things such as rain.
So, what obviously it does is it uses, because you have a map and it's geolocated, it uses known NEWA data sets, and then this is the annual average, and it interpolates to find the annual average for that farm. And then in terms of soil type, it uses SMAP, where that's available. So that is another constraint, I guess, in the use in that not all areas have SMAP, therefore the assessment of the soil type is at a much coarser level. And so there are certain hill country, there is less SNAP modern land seems to be disproportionately underrepresented in SNAP as well. So there are those factors to take into consideration.
And if we look at that factor of a rainfall, for example, as you say, you do 30-year averages, obviously, and we seem to have increasing variability in that regard around the country, if not around the world in that respect. But would you agree that often a lot of water quality issues are actually caused by non-average kind of events or issues in terms of some of the climate? For example, you could have perhaps an area or a catchment that's got an average of, say, 1,400 milliliters of rain or millimeters of rain a year, so that's an average of 3.8 millimeters a day. But then you could, have a 48-hour period where you receive 2 meters of rain. It could be 15% of your average total, and then the following 3 weeks you could be way down below your average, and those things would have an impact upon water quality. You accept that?
Yes, it obviously doesn't take into account those
sorts of things. And equally, whether you're in a drought period, and therefore the ability of the soil to absorb heavy rainfall. So the combination of one of those variables, soil moisture level, with another variable, such as rainfall, also throws over stairs. Why does it have weaknesses in that regard? Because of the algebraic way in which it uses
it. Yes, so it is doing your annual averages, so if you look at your overseer, that's giving you your, what your average value is, sort of over say 30 year period or 10 year period is going to be, rather than saying this year was a drought, therefore my end loss is 20 versus 22, which is why, part of the reason
yes.
it should be able to use it for the
And I think you did also talk earlier about, maybe exaggerating in terms of saying all the money in the world, but what we need is time and investment in order to develop better models or better systems. So I think models are challenging in their own right, they've all got their weaknesses. False precision, I think, has been referred to a lot, but to develop systems that are able to receive and take into account those much more specific variables over time within farms, within the sub-catchments, and then be able to utilise those to, I suppose, direct and guide mitigation in the short term and the long term. That's the optimal place we want to be, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think we've seen
Yes, I did get the sense that there was a case where a number of people in councils perhaps had taken the Ministry for the Environment to get word that they were going to produce something and people didn't need to worry and they haven't and now they're all scrambling. And that's a part of the reality, isn't it?
It is, and the problem with models is that you need data points with which to base that model upon, and while we're still focusing on the data that is available and suitable for use, and while we still have those gaps in the data, until you use those apps and we go back to the fundamentals, it's very difficult to generate that model that's going to fill those gaps, which is it just takes time.
Yeah, and we certainly don't want to be in a situation where we have a better model or a better system in 10 years' time, but nobody's been collecting the data that allows that to be utilised. So you agree that even if we haven't got the perfect model and accepting that overseer and nitrogen or stalker probably aren't those in terms of really measuring trajectories that are at a time, we should be collating and keeping the data, providing it to the regional council now in anticipation of the fact that there will undoubtedly be other measures and other systems that may be able to utilise that moving forward. Do you think that's critical?
It is critical that there is data available. I'm not sure that it's critical that all farmers need to do that. And my example for that would be the Betterman Farm Survey, that is statistically representative of the sector, that is a far more comprehensive data set than what is in either the nutrients or how they use it. Or in obviously a farm dry stock. So actually that data is there, that I'm aware of for dry stock and the next 20 years worth of it. And so I would anticipate that if you use overseer or the endless scorecard and you're collecting the data for that, if you have another model and it doesn't have it and it requires different data, you need to have those gaps. So it's going to be very difficult to anticipate exactly what data is required, but I would suggest that there are other data sets available that we have that would be suitable for that use in the future.
But some of the data is going to be collected within the context of the active living management plans is going to be important, so it's not simply the broader beef and land data sets that already exist, but the specific on-farm data sets are also going to be important, And obviously you appreciate that we've got references to an accounting system. So it's not a model, but at least an accounting system being created as part of PC1, maybe it seems to be from the original council's perspective at an early stage. But you know, it's critical that that type of system is developed.
Provide a bit of a discussion of critical source area management in your appendix 6 to your which gives some information about critical source areas. We also have definitions of critical source areas that have been provided for us. Most of the definitions that I read sort of can be traced back to the resource management National Environment Standards for Freshwater Regulations. So the definition that I read in those seems to be repeated fairly frequently in PC1 and in various forms in PC1. Now, hearing what you say about critical source areas in your literature here, and the definition that is provided for in the regulations, is that definition in the regulations complete in your view? Does it capture all that we needs to be understood about critical source areas? Area means a landscape feature, such as a gully, swale, or depression, that accumulates runoff from adjacent land and delivers, or has the potential to deliver, one or more contaminants to one or more rivers, lakes, woodlands, and drains, or rivers, regardless of whether there is any water in there at the time.
So I think it's leaving let's talk about the swales and gullies, which is that first obvious critical source area, but it's leaving out those areas of the farm zone. For example, a winter crop padding in itself is a critical source area. Bare soil would be a critical source area. We talk about the tracks and around crops, those sorts of things. So to me, that's limiting it to some of those physical characteristics of the land rather than some of the physical characteristics that we might be imposing on the land.
Yes, I think you talked about the potential sources of the contaminants and the pathway that might take those contaminants to a water body. So this definition that I just read out really is that second part. It's about the pathways,
yes.
But it doesn't focus in on the actual sources of the contaminants. Would that be your view? So do you think that in terms of directing attention to the specific parts of the landscape that the farmer and the plan certifiers need to have identified, that extra bit needs to be in the definition or could profitably be in the definition?
Yes, I definitely do, and that comes to, I think, some of the discussion around what's occurring in some of these patterns, it's when the people streams and things, it is you sometimes have a physical characteristic, but you can actually minimise to quite a degree the contaminant by stop making the acceptable distance, I repeat again. Yes, I definitely do think that
also sort of hearing or I'm picking up that there appears to be some sort of overlap, if you like, between ephemeral streams and critical source areas. Are all critical source areas likely to be ephemeral streams? And I suppose the converse is true, that not all ephemeral streams are going to be critical source areas.
No, but I suspect that a lot of ephemeral streams, when you overlay a management, when you have stock, will become critical source area.
I guess if I'm getting to the people skirting around the issue that some parties in this are encouraging us to think that or to apply stock exclusion to all ephemeral streams. Are you in favour of that approach, or is there some other sort of nuanced way that
from a practicality position, I don't see how we practically can. But in situations where that risk is great, so you've got large numbers of animals in that paddock grazing, or it's winter or those sorts of things, you know, like I will be excluding stock either from the paddock itself or by a team.
Would it be that if you have addressed the critical source area issues and mitigations for those, you might have captured also the ephemeral stream areas that need to be mitigated as well?
Yes.
So that there could be other ephemeral stream areas that actually don't need mitigation.
Yes.
And so that all ephemeral streams are not necessarily the problem, but some of them are, and those ones are now will be critical source areas.
And if you have the understanding of the connections between the property, you could have entertainment, but or some of it's actually in one area that is probably a larger image.
Okay, thank you. That helps understand that.
Good afternoon, Dr. Crystal. Apologies for having to go back over some of the ground we've already covered, but at the end of the day, we've got to make the decision, so I want to make sure that I understand things very clearly. And I also noticed that Pennell's comment about his worst nightmare. And so one of the things that I believe in cases like this is you have to look at both the big picture and the detail. In any one of them in too much detail without consideration of the other will get you into trouble. And at the moment I'm having difficulty in seeing what comes after PC1. I know that's a separate process, but I think it's important that there is some understanding of how this one will feed into the next one, and that what we can do here to make that more efficient is important. So I'll lead you through some things, and then His Honour will probably pick up on some of the questions that arise from that. One of the two main requirements of PC1 is to make sure sufficient information is gathered to enable soundly based decision making in the future, and the other one is obviously the outcomes to apply territory by month. And that's obviously paramount, and I think there's a real need to understand what farming can or cannot do to contribute to that. And we've heard already about the issue of 60% of the sediment coming from water courses, stream erosion, things like that. So I think it is important that we do understand what farming can realistically contribute to mitigation. And so that's where some of my emphasis comes from. I've got to say I was quite daunted when I saw the length of your evidence, but when I read it for the second time, I read it twice already, I found it very, very helpful in the evidence. Very thorough, and it addresses the issues that I think that we need to look at very carefully. So thank you for that. And in terms of the relativity between loads from dairy and dry stock, I was initially looking for just a high-level idea. Your information goes into sort of subcatchment level, which is also important. But I now have a much more contributor, my understanding is their expectation is that they will do this bit as well. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely. And I was saying potentially lesser contributors of saving nitrogen.
Yes.
But sediment and phosphorus definitely areas that cluster of
plants. Okay. I always like to talk and understand in simple English rather than technical terms. And so I'd like to deal with each of the four contaminants separately to try and make sure that my understanding is correct. And starting with sediment, it seems to me that the two primary requirements are critical source areas and the sensitive streams. Is that correct?
Yes, and I think as well some of those really erosion prone areas. And again, I'd like to mention Dr. Dupree's evidence, because I think that that indication of that small area in PC1, that 1.3%, that if assuming that analysis is correct, I think that we're all aware of the critical source areas within a paddock, but I think what that has done is identify a critical source area within the region, and we could get really big bang for buck if we focus in on some of those, on that at the regional level.
I see that as something that will come out of the next plan change, hopefully, in terms of focusing on that. And I don't know if that's the same as the one in the Waipar catchment where there was a big slip a couple of years ago, and there's still sediment going into the rivers from that. But those kind of things, I think, are something that the council will have to deal with. And I'm really thinking of on-farm management for the moment. And so would those be the two main ones?
Yes, but also the erosion and erosion.
Within a farm?
Within a farm, so pole planting, to stabilise hillsides, also potentially retiring of some, if there are some areas that are extremely erosion prone, could be retirement of those areas.
Okay. So that leads me to my next question, is that there will need to be a staged approach. So in the first FEP, Farming Management Plan, there will be a series of actions that will be undertaken over a certain period of time. I don't want to put a time frame on that either, because I think that is farm specific. But then what I would think is going to be important is thinking of what happens next. So whether the farm environment plan system should include, this is now, this is where we will look to go if things don't achieve what we want. And the reason for doing that is that I am concerned that we could spend another 10 years before we actually have a plan for doing the next stage.
Yes.
Do you see any merit in that?
Yes, I do. When you see if we don't get where we want to go, we could actually go beyond. If we're achieving it, and these things are practical and they're going to reduce contaminants, I just don't think there is a need. And in my mind, we are always, if the farm plans will always be looking for the next, what we can do to improve water quality.
Yeah, I'll come back to that in relation to nitrogen in a moment. But I think in some of the things you said before, that there would be certain things that we've done as a priority now to get the biggest bang for the buck. But in expectation that there is so much to do, that there will be other things that need to be done, would it not be sensible to start thinking about those now, so that farm planning can be looking at, this is perhaps coming back to Mr. Pennell's worst nightmare. He started to think of what might I have to do, what can I do, so that that can be started to be thought about earlier, rather than find in 10 years' time that we haven't achieved what we want, and then have to start thinking about it.
Yes, and I would like to
think
that in identification of when you're looking at waterways, etc., you're not just thinking about to meet the current regulations, you would be thinking forward for how would I fit in the cost of fencing, the next 5-degree slopes or the next X percent of streams, etc.
Absolutely. So it's almost an indicative long-term plan for a farm. And so it goes beyond the immediate 5 years or 8 years or whatever. And obviously there'll be more detail at the beginning rather than at the end. But anyway, that's just a thought of where my thinking is going. long-term objective. I know this is only dealing with the first stage, but I think unless we think where's this taking us, we're not doing the best we can. I think it's important to do the best we can. In terms of phosphorus, other than those two measures and monitoring your soil phosphorus levels and various things like that, are there any other measures that you see as being foreseeable in terms of phosphorus management in the 10-year climate plan, for example?
Phosphorus management will come, it'll come down to the ultimate values being minimised by the main flow pathways, not as well as the main flow, and through deposition of down into the water.
That's fencing streams and different source areas and things like that. So it's basically the same thing you said, the management plus looking at the cost and feed level. Okay, thank you. And in terms of E. coli, which is a bit of a challenging one, particularly in terms of what you find with commercial vegetable production and some of the levels appearing to go up when the scientists look to go down. Other than those two measures of critical source areas and fencing streams, are there any other measures that will help control E. coli?
One of the other sources would be effluent systems and potential losses through refrigerant flow pathways through soil. So where it's not being attenuated, it's pathways to control.
That's going to be a bit of a challenge, like finding them in the first place, but it's a challenge. Okay. And in terms of priorities for those three contaminants, where would you see the priority coming? Particularly in terms of, assuming that you're able to get all the critical source areas identified and managed, in terms of streams, where would you see the priority coming?
Priority has to be meeting the current regulations.
Yes.
And then I guess the priority would, you would look at those receiving bodies and what catchments do we have to, you know, where is this a bigger issue really, and then I'd be prioritising those areas. And so on a farm, at an individual farm level, it might be that nitrogen is not a great risk from the farm, but there's a lot of dry stock farms, and but nitrogen is actually a risk in that catchment. And you may have identified all those nitrogen risk mitigations, but in general you'll be focusing on those open nitrogen pathways. So it will definitely need to take into account that catchment context.
Yeah. So do you see that the management focus should be on a sub-catchment or an individual farm, or both? And what's the relationship between that? Would one have greater priority than the other?
I think a farmer can only do what they can do within the bounds of their property, and but I think the severity knowledge is power. And so an understanding of that catchment and how what you're doing on farm is impacting your sub-catchment, your community, I think that's really powerful. And so I think that the understanding of the catchment may help with prioritisation on farm, but again, farm can only control.
So in a catchment where sediment is the issue, the farmer would give priority to that rather than something that's less a priority. Is that what you see being done? Or do you expect them to try and do the best they could on all of the others within the reason?
Well, I think it comes down to time and money. So there may be low hanging fruit. So if you're a tiny sediment, you're going to get all three contaminants.
Yes.
So you're going to get phosphorus and E. coli for free.
Yeah.
And it comes down to, so there will be some low-hanging fruit that you can do regardless, and then you've got time and money, and you have to figure out where you can, where you're best to participate.
Now I'd like to just turn to nitrogen for a moment. And you've identified stocking rates, synthetic nitrogen applied, nitrogen served as an important supplement to some of the key factors that you've addressed.
Those are some of the risk
factors. And His Honour mentioned Dr. Olivoli's modelling yesterday, which talked about the same things. And so I think there's common ground there that those are things that are going to have to be focused on. And this is where I think looking at the long term is important, because based on two different pieces of evidence, there's a need to remove something like 3,000 tons a year of nitrogen from the catch from farming or from anthropogenic activities. And so we need to be thinking about how to do that longer term as well as in the short term. And this is where the debate about oversee around the nitrogen risk scorecard comes in. And my understanding of your evidence is that you think oversee should be retained as an option, and that its ultimate role in the future is probably yet to be determined, depending on what happens. Okay, I'll stop. Thank you. One of the things why I think nitrogen is so important is that there is a paper by Roland Stenger, Nitrogen Language, and a paper and a statement that it shows that the load to come is not such a significant issue as one thought, and that's good. But the other implication from that paper is that when you look at the net travel times for when nitrogen gets into the farm, the way it feeds in the water, it's possibly between 5 and 15 years for much of the catchment. So that means that any improvements that are undertaken on the farm will not start to show up in the catchment for possibly 10 years after the improvements are in place. And so that concerns me in terms of ensuring that enough is done with nitrogen, because that's going to be one of the big issues all the way through. Because even if you remove the sediment, you're still going to have water quality issues from the nitrogen. So do you have any thoughts on whether those lag times are reasonable? Have you had a chance to look at that, or is that outside your area?
That's outside my expertise, but those are just some of the lag times. What I hear from your experts,
yes. So if we assume that the measures on average were in place within 5 years, could be anywhere between 10 and 20 years before significant changes are seen in the environment. Do you have any magical solution to this? Well, that can be addressed. Can you just give me an easy one?
Could I be able to retire early if I do? I would say that it's important to keep that in mind, because it may be that farmers will be implementing these mitigations, and maybe when it's not showing up in water quality, the blame could be on those farmers who are not doing enough, but actually it's because of those lag times, so we need to remember that those lag times do occur, because we can't go back in time, we know what we can do from here. And so, I do think that we need to be mindful, because farmers will be implementing mitigations and reducing their nitrogen loss to water in the interim, but we're not going to see that in the water quality.
Yeah, I think really you've confirmed what I've been concerned about for a little while. It does need to be addressed. And the only way I can see that being addressed really is through the next plan change, in terms of setting realistic expectations for what can happen, and dealing with all the different land uses, as you say, like the high-risk erosion areas, forestry, point sources and things like that. So there's not a lot we can do here other than get the ball moving, but I think setting those expectations realistically for everyone will be critical, and I understand you agree with that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Crystal. I'd just like to follow on in relation to that and go back to an answer that you gave in relation to, I think it was questions by Ms. Cooper, Director General, about minimum standards and concern about a sort of a market situation in relation to the work of certifiers. I think that leaves to one side the way in which the certifiers would be operating. But you did say one thing in response to that, because the farm environment plans were not designed originally to be regulatory tools. Yeah. And you do need to answer,
we'll
record this. So. But on the other hand, your evidence and the evidence of a number of other experts is that the farm environment plan is probably the most direct way to get on-farm change to improve the situation.
Absolutely.
Right. So one of the things that the court has talked about during this process is the importance that there be no backsliding. That we that we make progress and we continue to hold on to the progress that we do make. Do you agree with that? And so one of the issues there will be, what is the mechanism then to make sure that farmers make progress and that they don't backslide? And in legal terms, that if need be, enforcement can occur to make sure that that happens. Now this may be getting outside your field and you may not want to comment on that. If that's the case, just say so. Yeah, but do you agree that there needs to be something against which both progress can be measured, and if people are going backwards or not doing the things which the plan may require or their farm environment plan may require, that there be a way of holding that or holding them accountable?
Yes, no, I do. And can I clarify what I was saying that it wasn't designed as a regulatory tool? I understand that. It is a useful, it is a great way to use that. But when we design those farm plans, if we're keeping in mind that it has two uses, so that the farmer is still able to get the use of the value from it as well, I think that's what I was saying.
Sure. Then, in terms of what Commissioner Hodges was asking you about and the conclusions that Dr. Olivoda reached in relation to his modelling, it may well be that targets or goals or whatever they may be, I mean, we've got a lot of stuff in the plan change about target attribute studies. It seems to me that those are things which you and other scientists will work out from the data that is collected. They aren't things that the farmer on a day-to-day basis will actually go out and say, oh, yes, okay, chlorophyll is at this level and so on.
Yes, and for clarification, I have no expertise in how those values are calculated.
No.
And so we do need values in terms of at the farm level for a farmer. What is it that is leaving my property that I need to reduce?
But then we also need to identify what are the things being done in terms of farm management that have an effect on those factors, don't we? And that comes back to things like stocking rates, nitrogen production, supplementary feed, area covered, or area effectively being farmed.
Yes, it does. But it does need to be nuanced. So stocking rate, for example, you can have the same stocking rate of sheep as you do of cattle, completely different levels of risk. And so when we look to the data that we're wanting to keep or collate, we do need to be sure that we are not inadvertently penalising somebody because we haven't nuanced that data enough.
Yes, well, and that's where the schedules of the plan change are good in terms of having one rule for everyone. It's a bit of a slogan around that, one rule for everyone. When possibly, as you say, the nuance should be, well, the way you achieve the objective that the rule or the rules are designed to achieve may well mean that there are different pathways to getting to that objective. Possibly the enforcement issue, and again, you may not feel that this is within your field, but others may, possibly this is to reflect the fact that in terms of environmental law, we don't just prosecute everybody for tripping over, you know, because, you know, 60 kilometres an hour, you get a ticket. We don't necessarily work that way in terms of environmental control. It may well be that we use other mechanisms such as patent notices or enforcement orders to try to achieve qualitative outcomes as opposed to penalising people for missing a quantitative tariff. Do you have any experience in that? No. All right. Well, I've said that in order to alert people to what I may ask them. What I will ask you, because you did refer to it, is in terms of the data, and I suppose this is probably the last point I want to raise with you, you've stressed the importance of that. You've also identified, and I'm not sure that this has been clear to us until you raised it, that of course the data sets are not limited to whatever, say, NFE might have or what the regional council may have. You said that Beef and Lamb has 70 years of dry stock information.
Yes, it
is. And is that readily available to the regional council or to NFE to put into their analysis?
Yes, it is, to different degrees.
Yes.
So in terms of on our website, there is readily available information. A lot of that is about production and financials, because back in the day, 70 years ago, that was what we were focused on. Increasingly, we have more environmental data, and we have more, we've got GIS data, so we can do overlays, etc. And we are working quite a bit with different regional councils as we're going through these processes to provide those data to go into some modelling. So yes, it is to varying degrees in terms of what you can get from the website versus, like I said, email.
Well, yes, I mean, again, one of the issues with data sets is how far you delve into it. And there were some questions asked to you about how you had used the SANS data in relation to this and how far you are able to go into that. And a bit like modelling, there are times when you have to be a little bit suspicious or sceptical or at least cross-check your data, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Questions, any matters arising out of the court's questions?
Thank you.
No. Thank you very much, Dr. Crisper, for your evidence. Your excuse.
There's a man called Richard Parks. Your Honour, just one matter, just in light of that line of questioning while my witness is approaching the witness box, your Beef and Lamb survey data. You'll recall that Mr. Burt produced a lot of that data in his evidence. He's actually still here, albeit in jeans and a jersey now. So, but I don't have any desire to recall him, but if there was something that had triggered, and he is still here and he could assist further, should you wish him to?
No, I don't think the issue was about investigating that data with him or Dr. Crystal or any other witness. The issue is knowing that the data is available. I think the concern that the court sometimes has in planning matters is that organisations can sometimes operate on their own in relation to these things. And even within some organisations, particularly organisations like councils, there can be silos within the organisation and people don't necessarily talk to one another. And the connections between what may have been obtained by Beef and Lamb 70 years ago for production and profitability and trading purposes, again, a good analyst may well be able to look at that and say, we know what we can infer from that information to give us something else going on. And that might be of use to the Regional Council or the Ministry for the Environment for their purposes in working out how can we regulate in a way that will actually achieve our objectives without turning a whole lot of people into willful, non-compliant operators because they say we don't see the point in this, we don't see where we're going. So thank you for that offer, but I don't think we need to recall to do. Again, it's more a case of just making clear to everybody that we need to think laterally about some of these things. And exactly as Dr. Crystal said, it's very important to have the data. Otherwise, we're basically just shouting the data.
Sure.
Thank you.
Is your name Richard Parks? And are you a director of SusAg Farm and Environmental Planning Limited?
Yes.
And you have expertise specialising in sustainable agriculture, farm systems, soil conservation, nutrient management, and extension and education. And do you confirm that you prepared a brief of evidence dated 26 July 2023?
Yes.
And that you have the qualifications and experience set out in that brief of evidence?
Yes.
And do you also confirm that you attended joint witness conferencing that resulted in a joint witness statement of farm systems experts dated 11 September 2023 being produced, and that your opinions expressed therein are consistent with the expert witness code of conduct?
Yes.
Now, do you have any corrections that you wish to make to your evidence in chief?
I do. So my copy of my evidence, paragraph 81, page 25, yes, I do. So, and paragraph 81, page 25 of my copy of my evidence. In the second line, it starts, ran 29 FEP and 3 freshwater farm plan workshops, FWFP workshops, with an average of 158 people. That should read a total of 158 people.
And subject to that change, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of knowledge and belief?
Yes.
And you've been in court this week?
Yes.
And have you been provided with a copy of Exhibit 4, which is a farm environment plan prepared by Balance that was produced by Mr. Hurst?
Yes.
Do you have any comments about that farm environment plan?
Yes, I'd say it's a comprehensive farm environment plan. I've also seen, we heard from Mr. Berry yesterday, I've seen the farm environment plan prepared for New Zealand Farm Assurance Programs, so not the PC1, and that's a very good example of a Hill Country sheep and beef farm environment.
Thank you, Mr. Parks. Would you remind me you are for any questions from my friends or the court?
Thank you. Mr. Conway?
No, thanks, sir. No,
Mr. Fisher? No, thank you.
No, sir, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pennell?
No, thanks.
No, thank you. O'Keele's not here. Mr. Rutten?
No, thank you, sir.
Who's on there?
Just one topic.
Thank you.
Do you have, or can you obtain from the bundle of phase 2 resource management freshwater farm plan regulations 2023? And so that's volume 501, tab 7.
Would that be part 1 of that,
sir? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not too sure. If you could just have those handy. So first of all, what's your understanding of the connection between target attribute states in the plan change and climate environment plans for VM?
I don't have a understanding.
Yeah. Alright, because in paragraph 71 of your evidence you talk about the King Country River Care Group,
yeah,
and there's an example of a catchment group, and Mr. Berry gave evidence about the King Country River Group and some difficulties that he had had with obtaining information from the council about water quality data in that respect, and that's around paragraphs 59 to 61 of this evidence. So at a catchment level at least, if not at an individual farm level, it's going to be important for that group of farmers to understand what they're trying to achieve in the water body, in the water bodies in terms of in-stream targets, isn't it?
Yes.
And so with the freshwater farm, farm plan regulations, I understand that that's fed in through the CCCV, which is Catchment Context Challenges and Values. And so the regulations say that recertification, and this is regulation 27, you possibly don't need to go to it, but recertification occurs 5 yearly with the freshwater farm plans. Can you, so the other aspect to this is that, as you would have been aware possibly, that the council is embarking on an exercise very shortly, at the end of next year, where it's going to review target attribute states for many catchments against what we call ecosystem health requirements. And I didn't see anything in the recertification process that meant that that review of the farm plans has to be informed by new attribute states or new information about health targets. Can you enlighten me at all?
The farm plan. My understanding is the farm plan will still need to sit within the catchment context. I can't speak specifically about the recertification after 5 years, but I can't see that that would change.
What do you mean by that? It would still sit within the catchment
context. Well, I can't see that the requirement for the catchment context wouldn't still be applicable when it comes to recertification.
Thank you. Because we've heard this morning that the farm plans are a living document, so the 5 yearly review would presumably feed into that concept in terms of looking at what you've done and what you're still to achieve, because your evidence says it, paragraph 34C, that usually it's a 10-year, you look at a 10-year horizon?
The 10-year horizon, so yes, the 10-year horizon provides, you know, it's an outline over a period of time. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So it's generally around 10 years?
10 years, and I also say, you know, if it's, when I'm providing the service, my recommendation is an annual review of that 10-year work program to outline what's going to happen over the next 4 months. Because, as we've heard from various witnesses, it's been, you know, just said yourself, it's a, you know, it's a dynamic living document, and that check, that review is part of that ongoing process.
Okay. no, thanks for that. You might not be able to answer this, but my reading of the recertification, 5-year recertification and the farm plan regulations is that it's to do with that review of what you achieve, what you achieved, what you haven't achieved, rather than a fundamental swing, because there have been new targets that have been developed in a particular sub-catchment.
Yeah, I can comment on that.
Right. Thank you. Thank you,
sir. Thank you. Mr. Ferguson?
No, nothing.
Can we say thank you for re-examination?
Thank you.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Clark. Just a couple of questions, please. You notice, or you noted from page 53 of your evidence that the most significant risks of adoption of the farm environment plans include regulatory uncertainty and unclear communications of the farm environment plan requirements. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. What can be done to minimise the regulatory uncertainty concern?
I think the final decision coming out of PC1 as to exactly what's expected from farmers, and I also speak to the value in that alignment between the requirements in PC1 and pressure farm plans.
Okay, no, that's fine, that's helpful. You would have heard my discussions with Dr. Crystal about starting to look a little bit further forward in the farm environment plans, particularly with regard to nitrogen, because I think it's a reality that if 3,000 tonnes of nitrogen have to be removed over an 8-year period, each farm is going to have to move some distance from where they are now. And just thinking about your evidence and what we've heard before, it may well be that the first farm environment plan simply works on the basis of the 10-year program that we're talking about. When the first 5-year review comes into place, you then have the most up-to-date catchment context, and you could then start thinking about the longer-term possibilities. So in their planning, farmers could say, well, I don't really want to do that, because it's going to not be profitable, but I might be able to do this, so it's trying to provide certainty for them that something's going to change. It still leaves them with the flexibility to deal with it. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, I think in the short term, the certainty about exactly what they've got to do now produces clarity through the process, and we're already seeing with the likes of King Country River here that, in my opinion, that farmers and farming communities responding to drivers to change, of which regulation is one of those drivers. But the value in the farm plan and participating in that farm planning process and the extension of the adoption support that sits around that farm plan, and in my evidence I say that the certification is one part of that adoption support. Catchment groups, catchment community groups, industry bodies, the regional council also can play a role in that adoption support. It provides the opportunity for the conversation, because what you're outlining, and I'm sure everyone agrees, it's a pretty big issue that needs to be tackled. Set number one in any behaviour change is awareness, and then what's important through any change process is that change is supported, particularly. And we've heard from Dr. Crystal that very specific areas within a catchment that are particular contaminant loss hotspots particularly a tailored funding process that was outlined in my evidence, and is that it enables those very specific targeted conversations to be had.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That's fair enough. I'm responding to the concerns raised by a number of farming businesses. They want certainty. I think it's also important is honesty. And the honesty is that there's 3,000 tonnes of nitrogen that has to be lost somewhere.
Yeah.
So the sooner that's put on the table and people can understand, okay, I am going to be affected by that, it gives them 10 or 15 years to plan for possibly rather than 3 or 4. That's what I'm exploring with you.
I would agree. Yes, particularly if you're looking at some of the change that might be required, mine needs to be managed over an extended period of time, and it's also important to people's decisions when it comes to borrowing, lending, farm development, farm succession planning, etc.
Thank you, and I apologise to the people at the back, and you didn't tell the judge to kick me, so. Anyway, thank you for that. That's very helpful. And just one last question or clarification, please. You've helped you provide an estimate of the range of costs in preparing a farm environment plan. Do you have an indication of the cost of certification and audit of such plans?
No.
Thank you.
Well, I might just follow up in a related thing. We've had concerns expressed to us by farming witnesses about capacity to bring the process forward in terms of who's available to assist in preparing the plans, who would be available to certify them. I mean, from the work that you do and your knowledge of the area, are you able to give us any evidence about capacity in New Zealand to, capacity in the Waikato, capacity in New Zealand to implement these measures?
Look, it's something I hear around the country, a lot of concern about the capacity to implement these measures. I guess much like farmers have been looking for certainty, so have industry professionals or people with suitable qualifications who could enter this space. My own experience in other areas is the people start to appear. If there's a need, there's definitely been a lot of businesses that have been aligning themselves for a period of time, waiting for stuff to happen in this space. So again, unless there's a demand from what I've seen in other regions, I'm seeing emerging is so will the people. And whether works in the tertiary education sector, if you're someone looking at entering training, if you're seeing a clear demand of work in the space, that's going to influence your decision.
Yes, and I suppose that's a good point you make, that New Zealand can reflect on the fact that there's a reasonably strong background tradition in education at tertiary level for agriculture, farming, primary production generally. So that's what you were saying might be the base for that.
Yeah.
Any questions arising?
No.
Thank you very much for your...
Something has come to mind in relation to Commissioner Hodges' question, and his question was around, did I have any insight into the potential cost of certification? If it's of any value, I'll give a quick explanation from someone who's I'm not certified professional farm plans, that hasn't been right out in the regions that I work at the moment, but involved in certification within the Greater Wellington region. Someone comes to me and wants me to certify their plan. The process that I need to go through to give me confidence to certify that plan is very similar to the process that I would go through to develop the plan. So I outline some of the steps in my evidence. Some of the timeframes will likely, or I would hope, would be shorter, but that would depend on the confidence that I get from the quality of the plan that's put forward to. So the more
Like your next witness is Ms. Crowfoot.
That's right. And then Ms. Foster.
Then Dr. Lemire.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
I have the order somewhere. That's all right. That's fine.
Thank you.